Charles Hearst is the captain of this revolutionary educational venture. It's my pleasure and privilege to introduce him now.
My thanks to the sister for that beautiful introduction. Black sisters are so beautiful. I think that I'm going to talk rather randomly today. I had a prepared set of remarks and I forgot them, which is probably for the better. I've seen a few things since being here that really make me want to talk about something else anyway. And I'm inspired to do this because of some of the common denominators that I find existing on this campus and some other campuses that I've had the good fortune to visit. And included among these common denominators are some of the faculty attitudes, some of the community attitudes, and I think maybe some of a lack of understanding on the part of some of the black people about the nature of the situation in which we find ourselves. So I think I'm going to sort of concentrate on the issue of survival and the problems of survival in the kind of world that we're living in. I think the least luxury that any young black person can afford today is the luxury of being naive about what it's going to take to survive and the nature of the enemy that we're going to have to fight in order to survive. And I would suggest that those people who are not black but who would like to be allies with black people in their pursuit of freedom, that they would want to be cognizant of these same things and be wary of some of the same traps. Before I begin, I do want to say that so pleased to know that Sonia Sanchez was here. And any of you in the audience who have not read Queens of the Universe in the most recent issue of the Black Scholar, this is January, February, Memoriam to W.E. Du Bois, ought to do so, ought to get that, and I hope that everyone here will subscribe to Black Scholar. I think it's the most scholarly journal on black thought today. There is nothing that equals it in the United States. And anyone who claims to be serious about insight into blackness and insight into black thought ought to be reading this publication. Certain that the information on how to get it is available. Queens of the Universe sort of tickled me when I read it because it starts out, we black women have been called many things, foxes, matriarchs, whores, boogie bitches, sweet mamas, black bitches, sapphires, sisters, and recently queens. And it's that queen part that has really gotten to me, you know, because that's all these beautiful black queens who are beginning to realize that that's what they are, queens. Not lib movement specialists, queens. I think in beginning to understand the nature of the situation of black people in the United States, we can come to the quote from E. Franklin Frazier, Black Bourgeoisie, the African family system was destroyed, and the slave was separated from his kinsmen and friends. Moreover, in the United States, there was little chance that he could re-knit the ties of kinship and old associations. If by chance he encountered fellow slaves with whom he could communicate in his native tongue, he was separated from them. From the very beginning, he was forced to learn English in order to obey the commands of his white masters. Whatever memories he might have retained of his native land and native customs became meaningless in the New World. The very fact that the majority of slaves were young males practically eliminated the possibility of recreating a social organization that could perpetuate and transmit the African cultural heritage. And I think that ought to give you the beginnings of an insight into the nature of the situation that black folks are in today, and it ought to tell you the why of institutions as we're trying to build them today in places like Malcolm X. And it ought to tell you the why of black studies programs, and it ought to tell you the why of the content of black studies programs, and it ought to tell the black people who are listening the why of how, why they're going to have to do it themselves, not depending on somebody else to do it for them. The extent of the degradation of black people, I thought, was brought out most vividly in the following passage of Fugitive Slave And I think this is another one of the cornerstones of the substructure on which the new liberation is going to have to be built. And I quote, "My brothers and sisters were bit off first, and one by one, while my mother, paralyzed by grief, held me by the hand. Her turn came, and she was brought by Isaac Riley of Montgomery County. Then I was offered to the assembled purchasers. My mother, half distracted with the thought of parting forever from all her children, pushed through the crowd while the bidding for me was going on to where Mr. Riley was standing, and she fell at his feet and clung to his knees and begged that he would buy her baby as well as herself and spare to her just one of her children. Can it be believed that this man thus appealed to was capable not merely of turning a deaf ear to her supplication, but of disengaging himself from her with such violent blows and kicks as to reduce her to the necessity of creeping out of his reach and mingling the groan of bodily suffering with the sob of a breaking heart? And as she crawled away from the brutal man, I heard her sob out, 'Oh Lord Jesus, how long shall I suffer this way?' I must have been then between 5 and 6 years old. I said to myself when I read this passage that this, in truth, is the nature of the black experience in the United States. It's not only our beginnings, but it's sort of the story of all of our beginnings since that time, including right now. I think that one of the chief stains blemishing American history during all of the years of its existence, but particularly during the 1960s, is represented by the atavistic reluctance of this country to make freedom and equality a genuine reality for all people. In fact, as we enter the new decade of the 70s, the ignoble record of white America in the treatment of black America was easily documented as becoming worse with each passing day. Even as the nation has entered into the 70s, new instances of injustice have accumulated throughout this year. And strange to me, we've got a president and a Congress and many in education as well as in religion debating on and on as to whether black people should ever be given justice and equal rights. And the present conditions of crisis throughout the country sort of reflect the failure of an awful lot of things in this country, including such institutions as the University of Illinois, to do something about what the nation says is so precious to its heritage, the lack of freedom on the part of hundreds of thousands and millions of Americans. Now, the task of educating people, the task of educating black people, is much more difficult than if this same challenge had been confronted 20 years earlier. Because 20 years ago, there were still many black people as well as white people who thought that freedom could be gained if you prayed for it. I think that we've come to know now that freedom is something that you just don't get by praying. No people have ever gotten freedom by praying for it. You don't get freedom by asking for it. You don't get freedom by begging for it. Actually, and I'm not mounting any kind of threat, in all of the course of human history, people have gotten freedom for one reason and one reason alone, because they've been able to generate a kind of power that enabled them to sit down at the negotiating table and command the respect of those people with whom they wanted to negotiate. In other words, I'm not saying rapping away about freedom. I'm talking about getting the tools of power, the indices of power, what it takes to make people respect you, not giving a damn whether they like you or love you and all that or not. And love is a beautiful thing. It's a characteristic in the black community. Love is a beautiful thing, but love is not a requisite to respecting me and to respecting my right to freedom. I think that one could easily view the situation as we see it today as a generation of tokenism. Most of you have lived through the so-called civil rights struggle, which saw some minute improvement for a relatively small percentage of black people, some token inroads in business and industry, and a war on poverty that ended in a shambles with little monuments of tokenism all over the black community controlled by white people. Moreover, rather than a decrease in such as the incredible brutality of police toward black young people, there has actually been a shocking increase, with less being said about it any every day. Is it any wonder, then, that many young black people are rightly convinced that a scheme exists to systematically eliminate from the population all black people, or at least all who demonstrate a militant desire for self-sufficiency and freedom? I think that we can point to the assassination of the two young members of the Black Panther Party right here in the state of Illinois as an example of a new era of repression that has developed in these United States. These two young men, Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, were slain during a police raid in a private home while they were committing no offense against anyone. Results of an FBI investigation reveal that approximately 90 shots were fired by the invading police, with the remote possibility that one shot may have been fired in return by one of the eight young people in the house at the time of the attack. The raid was undertaken so rapidly and with such careful calculation that one of the men, Fred Hampton, was asleep when bullets from semi-automatic weapons and shotguns ended his life. Now, there are many other instances that we can talk about that ought to have people grieving and grieving during every single one of their waking hours. We could cite other instances by angry black youths of being sick of the system of repression that exists now. We could cite such things as the persecution of Huey P. Newton for a crime that even some of our most outstanding jurists have agreed he could not have committed, unless you can commit crimes while you are asleep, something that some white people seem to think about some black people. And then we could talk about the harassments of Eldridge Cleaver and the persecution of Brap Brown until he was hounded into hiding. No less threatening for those of us who are becoming greatly concerned about the climate that we're living in today, no less threatening is the case of Bobby Seale. And I think, too, that we're confronted now with something with no precedent here in the United States, the spectacle of what is happening to Angela Davis. And the tragedy here is not that Angela Davis is guilty of committing any crime for which they could put her in jail, except being guilty of speaking out for what she believed in and speaking out against those things that she knew to be wrong about our existing society. That's the only thing that Angela Davis did wrong. But the tragic thing about Angela Davis is her knowledge of a system that has become so corrupt that she could not be guaranteed of any kind of justice. And in order to get away from persecution, she had to flee. I've been a little upset with some of my brothers and sisters here recently because of the tendency to talk about freedom and to talk about liberation and talk about unity. And I'm saying to you that we ought to look at the example of Muhammad Ali and Angela Davis, and then we ought to go back into our little gatherings and talk again about freedom and justice and liberation and unity. It was irritating to me the other night to see these people parading behind Muhammad Ali, because Muhammad Ali was by himself for almost 3.5 years until people began to see that it was safe again to walk behind Muhammad Ali. This young man, at the very height of everything that was considered important in the society in which he had grown up, the time when he was a millionaire, that's what they trained people to want to think like, be a millionaire someday. No matter what happens in the rest of the world, no matter what happens to your people, no matter how hungry the people are that are with you, no matter how much injustice there is in this world, you be happy if you can be a millionaire. And Muhammad Ali looked at this and said, I don't want it. It ain't worth it to me. Those things that I believe in as a man, as a free man, as free as one can be in this country, those things are worth much more to me than money. And I will not fight this war that I know to be a criminal war, that I know to be a wrong war. I will not go against the principles of humanity upon which I base my life. And for this, he was hounded and persecuted. But I think that the terrible thing is that for so many months, he had to walk almost alone. And you see, as things began to cool off, we found all of the well-dressed many around him in his training room, in his room the other night. Well, I say that that same kind of togetherness cannot exist in the case of Angela Davis. Angela Davis deserves the moral and financial support of all of those who are concerned with seeing justice in this country. I think that we black students, black teachers, black educators in all echelons could do no less than speak out loudly demanding justice for this very beautiful sister who was willing to do what few will do, put her career on the line for those things that she believed in. But I think in order to be willing to do even the lip service that's involved in what I'm asking, we're going to have to get some minds together in a much better way than has been the case up to now. We have to understand what it is that's happening to us in this country, what has happened, and what promises to happen unless some intervening force is introduced. I think you need to understand what genocide is all about and what the practical probability of genocide is in this country, how genocide has been practiced. I think you have to understand what racism is all about in all of its diabolic forms. Now, I'm not just talking to black people when I use these terms, because most white people don't understand what genocide is, and they don't understand what racism is. But how the hell can you do something about something if you don't understand what the hell it is and don't believe it exists to begin with? Well, I can tell you that both genocide and racism are realities in these United States, and that's why blood is running in the streets, and that's why death is a more familiar partner of people who walk the west side and the south sides of Chicago than any other identifiable force. And I want to tell you what genocide is, and I just translate from the specific definition provided in Article 2 of the UN Conference on Genocide as drafted on November 11, 1946, and I quote, "In the present convention, genocide means any of the acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such. Number one, killing members of the group. Parenthetically, I can say that so-called justifiable homicides of police against black youths in all parts of the country is one example. And then second, causing serious bodily harm or mental harm to members of the group. And aside from the proven physical and psychological brutality in many forms by police, there is the large-scale psychological brutality that occurs in the nation's schools and colleges. And that's one of the things that you have to watch out for as students. And then thirdly, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about the physical destruction in whole or in part. Every city of any size with its slums is honest witness to the applicability of this article." Now, this definition provided by the United Nations probably does certify use of the term genocide as a very appropriate designation, growing out of the condition and the pathology that governs the way black people are forced to live and die in this country. Now, the rage of black people then in ghetto communities ought to be an understandable phenomenon growing out of the evidence that the charge of genocide is not only conceivable, but quite accurate. There can be little doubt that the injustice rendered against the black community during all of our years of presence in this country has been and continues to be so blatant that only the blindest bigot could deny its existence. Unfortunately, for those who would like to deny the presence of racism in our society, the racist system, which encourages, also perpetuates injustice against black people and is present and institutionalized in such as the University of Illinois. You see, they would like to have you think that by getting off down here in the country, away from some of these things that are happening every day, that they would like to have you think that those things no longer exist. Or they will no longer exist when you go back home. That is not the truth. When you go back home, things are going to be worse than ever. And that's why it is so necessary that young black people in these environs learn how to survive. Because you weren't brought here to survive, dear sister and dear brother. You were brought here to flunk out. And that's the case all over this country, all over this state. You might know that 85% of all of the black students in the colleges of Illinois are in the freshman and first semester of the sophomore year. And they don't intend for a hell of a lot to get past this point. And let me show you the situation that I'm talking about, because I'm talking about community survival. I'm talking about community survival in the real sense of the terms. And I'm not talking about it from a position of fear. You see, because I'm not afraid of anything that has to be done or anything that might come my way, and don't you ever forget it. But I know that it's not the name of the game to talk about committing suicide. The name of the game is to survive. We've got to have certain kinds of characteristics in our communities in order to become self-sufficient. Last year, do you know how many doctors graduated from the medical schools in the state of Illinois? In toto, that's all together. Two. Two black doctors graduated from the medical schools here in the state of Illinois. Now, what does that say for the future health needs of the black community? We are already in bad shape. There are only 6,000 black doctors in the entire United States, and 3,000 of these are 50 years or older. You see what the situation looks like? And people are going to put my folks, my young people, into trick bags that will have them thinking they're here for some kind of education and then run them out of school before they know better. Yes, you have to learn that the name of the game is survival and learn how to survive. Even if you have to ask some of your white counterparts who belong to fraternities how they survived, learn how to survive. I think that one of the major problems is represented in these institutions, such as the University of Illinois, is the reflection of the failure of education to make any real commitment to the elimination of racism. And this is probably one of the main causes of the deep-seated unrest prevailing on most campuses. It seems to be America's good fortune, actually, that some new voices are speaking out. That some people have become so fearful about the future that they no longer have any fears for the present. They are willing to put their careers on the line if necessary, if this will provide the necessary inspiration and insight required for young people to know what is going on today and what they must do in preparation for tomorrow. I think that one former president of a major university has warned that if this nation is unable to solve the critical problems of race, pollution, violence, and drugs, there just is no hope for the future. Now, this is another man talking, another former president talking. On racism and violence, he pointed out that he would be a bold man indeed who tried to assert on the record that we have made more progress than we have lost ground in the 24 months since the Kerner Report was issued. And this is your answer to people who say that things are getting better. Things are not getting any better. Things have no hope of getting better. And there's no point in your wishing that things are going to get better in the future unless you yourself become a part of the team that we can develop to assure the future for ourselves. But this would mean then that the responsibility for educating black people cannot reside solely in somebody else. Neither can we expect education of the kind that is inevitable to our survival to take place in the classroom. You are lucky if any of this takes place at all. It may be necessary as a matter of coping with the credentialing process for you to attend classes 15 hours or 18 hours a day. These folks been fooling themselves into thinking that that's what an educational program was. And that's why they ended up the dehumanized folks that they are today. And the only way that they're ever going to begin to become humanized is to start thinking outside of the framework represented by the present institution and start looking at what black humanism is all about and what black programs, black educational programs are trying to become. Because black educational programs are designed to make human beings out of people, not wanton killers. Black education programs are designed to help black people and others who are interested to know something about the black experience in this country, but not just to end there. To understand what racism, all kinds of racism, white racism, institutionalized racism are all about, the nature of the situation in which they find themselves, and the tactics of survival that are going to be necessary in order to make the way to ultimate liberation. Seems little question that if there is really going to be peaceful reconciliation of some of the many diverse differences existing now that threaten to engulf us and destroy all of us, administration, faculty members, students, and others who depend upon these institutions must come up with the answers to the existing problems or go down with that old sinking ship. I think that I want to talk a little bit before closing about, in specifics, about what I mean. I think that one of the real threats to the existence of young black people today is that the educational institutions of which they are a part demand that they deny themselves, deny their people, and treats them and teaches them in a way that would make them deny their community. I think that any educational system that is honestly devoted to the idea of liberation for all people and freedom for all people must be very concerned with the elimination of the mythology of inferiority. Because you see, whether it is in an educational institution or any other part of this society, we are surrounded by the myth of white superiority. So that it's so deeply embedded, so that whether people know it or not, beneath the surface, this is what prevails. Many, many white people in this country are convinced that they are superior to black people. And then, unfortunately, because of the nature of the educational situation, there are many black people who are convinced that they, too, are inferior. And I say over and over again that down in my gut, and that's the way we got to think, ain't no way in hell that any white person can ever be more intellectual or more human than I am. And I think that when the time comes that this can be, that the whole phenomenon of racism can be understood and its impact on the development of these kinds of myths can be understood, then we will begin to eliminate them. But white people in this country have become so hung up on their own hypersensitivities that if you mention, you say, a racist, they say, I ain't one. Racism, it doesn't exist. Well, what the hell is this condition that we have gotten ourselves into? Call it what you will. I call it racism, and I call you racist. And it's very difficult to live in this country without becoming a racist. I was one, too. And it's an excruciatingly painful job ridding yourself of the curse of racism. I am not a racist now. But the reason why I'm not a racist now is because I came face to face with the fact that I was a racist. And it was only in really studying Malcolm X and understanding how he too had to confront this same kind of phenomenon that I began to understand how the greatest human being who had ever lived was named Malcolm X El-Shabazz. You see? This man was so beautifully human. And his insights were such that he was very concerned with the survival of all people. But he knew that no people could survive as long as the world was contaminated by exploitation and other kinds of inhumane conduct growing out of this business of racism. He knew that we had to do something about this. But he also knew that in order to do it, we had to survive. So he told us, as some of the other black patriots, black heroes have told us, that we can no longer rely on other people to solve our problems. It's wrong of us to even expect that other people will educate our children and educate them properly. It's wrong of us to expect that other people are going to liberate us. The only solution to black problems is going to come out of black minds. And we're going to have a whole lot of black minds and a whole lot of effort from black minds. We don't have time to be wasting in a whole lot of nonsense rappings. And we don't have any time anymore for any of this foolishness that results in disunity, where we spend time fighting each other instead of fighting the real enemy. I think that we don't have time anymore, we don't have much time, that is, for planning what to do tomorrow. We've got to get at the business of preparing ourselves. And we have to prepare for whatever tomorrow holds. We have to hope that tomorrow holds peace and survival for all people. But at the same time, I think that all young black people have to become committed to the idea that freedom is the most important commodity of human existence, and life without freedom is a life not worth living. You know, these words were said first, and I say that to the white people in the audience in this country, by Patrick Henry. And you know, all the time he said that, everybody thought it was so great, and they put it into history books. As soon as the Black Panthers said it, I guess they took it out. But things have not changed. Human nature is such that it's alien to the existence of real people to live in any form of subjugation. And only because black people were so completely dehumanized by the nature of their experience in this country were they willing to tolerate for so long a condition of something less than human. But the situation is changing very rapidly and all over the country. I'm encountering the beautiful, beautiful, beautiful experience of black people coming together, of black people working like crazy to get their minds together. Black people talking to each other and black people relating to each other in ways that are new and strange as far as our history in this country is concerned. Black people beginning to understand that they never were satisfied with their slave state. Black people who are coming to know who Denmark Vesey was and what it meant, who know who Gabriel was, know who Nat Turner really was, not what that cat said he was. And they are walking with pride as they think about these men. And they recognize two very profound facts. One, that black people, whether they were free or whether they were slaves, could not be satisfied with a situation where all black people were not free. Because Denmark Vesey was a free man, but he gave up his freedom and his life in an effort to free others. Nat Turner was a slave and freed himself and could have escaped to the west or to the north, but he too said, no, my mission in life is to accomplish freedom for all of my people, or my life is not worth living. This is the kind of new inspiration that is permeating the being of black people. You see, it's a new approach to the experience of black living in the United States. It's one where black people are beginning to select their own heroes and worship their own heroes. But I think that today we are on the threshold of something that is even more important than the eras that I have alluded to of the past. I think that we're coming to the end of the myth of the super nigger. As you see, that's another way in which black people have been made to feel inferior. Every time some black brother or sister happened to push his or her way through, they would point out how super that person is, you know, how great they are. Of course, they would also try to endow them with as many white characteristics as possible. Adam Clayton Powell, it tickled me until they got in trouble. There was a great deal of speculation. He must be white. After he got all messed up there in the Senate, he can't be white. You see, that is the situation that we are living with. You see, we're coming now into this era where the super nigger will no longer be a necessity for our survival. We recognize that if there's such a thing as a super nigger at all, super nigger exists in every black man and every black woman walking on these streets today. And that's what you got to keep in mind. Anything that we will, we can do. And the time comes when we will that our liberation shall become a moment of reality in this country, then we will begin the excruciatingly painful task of preparing ourselves. And there is no shortcut to preparation. And the preparation does involve some of those things that are not so pleasant to do, but got to do. And preparation involves being willing to assume the responsibility for our own education and the willingness to pay the price, whatever the price might be. And when people come to know that you are willing to pay the price, it may be that you'll never have to pay it. You see? But you have to convince them out of a spirit of absolute seriousness that you are willing to pay the price. Now, I might say to the white members of this audience that I would hope that you would take these words as the thinking of black people, not in a spirit of whether you agree with it or not, or like it or not. I'm always encountering people, white people, who say, I don't agree with you. I don't think you are the mainstream of colored, black thought. And I wish that they would stop wasting their time and my time with such nonsense. The important thing is that I am the black president of a prestigious educational institution in the city of Chicago. And on the basis of that and that alone, you're supposed to listen to what I say and start thinking about it and try to figure out how you can do something about it. That's the way it is. Got to go back and poll the people to find out whether or not I'm for real and know what I'm talking about. I think that what we're trying to accomplish is very, very clear. And I think that the ways in which we're going to have to accomplish it are very, very clear. But it's a beautiful day that we're coming to, because there was a time when you couldn't say these things. You couldn't even say them to black people, but a beautiful thing now, you can say them to black people and we're together. So I want to say in closing that I'm very grateful for the opportunity to be able to share a few minutes with the black young people here at University of Illinois. I'm very pleased that some others, friends and others, saw fit to come out. I hope that if I have left not one other thing, that I have recreated in the minds of some of the black young people, sometimes tend to stray away, that not too long ago, six black people were shot in the black, in the back. Six black men were killed in Augusta, Georgia. You know, it's a funny thing. They're still talking about Kent State. Only reason why they're still talking about Jackson State is because of Kent State. See, but six black men were shot in the back. The autopsies were performed, and incontrovertible evidence that six black men were shot in the back. Now, we could go on and talk about all of the black men who had been shot in the back in the streets of Chicago and every other major city in the United States. But here was a massacre of six grown men. And not one single institution in this country had the guts to stand up and speak out against it and demand that some kind of justice be introduced. And right to this day, I have yet read in any newspaper, not in any newspaper, of any counteraction taken against these men who shot six black men in the back. Now, I don't know what you call this situation that we're living in at the present time. I think at the very least, you're going to have to recognize it as a time of very serious crisis for black people. And if we're going to survive, we're going to have to be very sensitive to what's going on, the patterns of what's going on. We're going to have to come together in a very close spirit of unity and be our protection from each other and from the outside. We cannot find these kinds of situations where we contribute as members of our own destruction. In some instances, even our own self-destruction. I think that the handwriting on the wall is very, very clear. And I say again that if freedom is something really meaningful to you, then let's be willing to pay the price of freedom. If we don't, the Agnews will get you.
Ending, or you could go for miles and miles.
My guest is Dr. Charles G. Hirst, the president of Malcolm X College on Chicago's West Side. I won't go into Dr. Hirst's long and impressive list of credentials as an educator because we wouldn't have the time. But I would like to mention that the establishment of a junior college like Malcolm X within the Chicago public school system is an innovation in itself. Dr. Hirst, in setting up the college, has come under attack from both blacks and whites in the Chicago public school system, and it has been noted that were it not for his determined devotion to obtaining quality education for Chicago's black students, Malcolm X College might never have come into being. Dr. Hirst, we appreciate your taking time out from your busy schedule today to talk on this program. Dr. Hirst spoke today before the annual convention of the Illinois Junior High School Principals. Dr. Hirst, you told the educators in that meeting that the public educational establishment has failed miserably in the education of black children. Could you explain this position?
Well, yes. And before giving the particulars of that, I think I ought to emphasize that the failure of the public educational system in our country is a total one. That is to say, even the successes have really been failures. And this is why campus unrest, to be dealt with, must be probed in terms of what goes on or doesn't go on in our high schools and junior high schools. Young people are not prepared psychologically, intellectually, or morally to cope with the inconsistencies and contradictions that one becomes aware of in coming into the collegiate scene. But now, aside from that, as I mentioned earlier today, last 10 years in the 1960s, more than 7 million people, young people, were pushed out of our public high schools. Now, this is an atrocious figure, and it indicates a contribution to the human junk pile that no country can really afford. In other words, no country can afford to waste its human potential in these ways. Now, in terms of percentages of the total population, the community hardest hit is the black community. And some statistics that I used also today showed that in some instances we have a high school population at the ninth grade level of 3,000 that reduces to 300 at the 12th grade graduating level, with most of these young women. Now, any system that can successfully eliminate this high percentage of aspirants for some kind of opportunity is a very inefficient system, and certainly cannot be called a successful system unless the aim of the institution is to push students out.
One of the favorite terms that you used in talking to educators this morning is you urge them to sensitize. You urge them to have a more sensitive approach in their objectives for a quality education.
Mm-hmm.
What does this mean to you?
Well, it means first that our schools, particularly inner city schools, ghetto schools, call them what you like, schools in minority group communities, are staffed by alien teachers. They're teachers who are really more like an occupation army than they are like members of the school community. I sometimes call them Russians, because they rush into the school in the morning and they rush out as fast as they can, for legitimate reasons most of the time. They got to run home and cook dinner for a husband or something like that, and home may be 25 or 30 or even 40 miles away traveling the expressways. Now, this kind of teacher not only fails to be sensitive to the immediate needs of her students, but if she ever had any knowledge of the community, she loses that knowledge over time. And I'm suggesting that any teacher, in order to be effective with a student, or for that matter, administrator, in order to be effective in helping to formulate a program for that student, has to be sensitive to the characteristics of the student and the community. He has to know those things that are important to the community. He has to know the attitudes of the student and the whys of these attitudes. He has to know what the aspirations are of the student. He has to know what are the myths in that community and what are the realities. He has to know, or she has to know, what makes people cry in that community and what makes people laugh in that community. Most of the educators that I was talking with today, as well as most that I talk with every day, do not fit the description that I would give of a sensitive teacher. What I was also saying, by the way, to those folks was that in order to compensate, because I think there is a compensatory mechanism that can be introduced into the educational process, but it's going to mean the utilization of a kind of teaching personnel which has not been traditional. That is to say, I'd like to see a co-partnership in the classroom where the professional teacher was aided at all times by a person from within the community. This is an indigenous person of semi-professional status, or it's sort of irrelevant, you could even call them professional status, but trained in a different way. The presence of that person could help the teacher when she tended to stray away and get into trouble. Now, in addition to this, I think that there ought to be regular orientation and reorientation programs for everyone who functions in the school milieu. This means that not only must the teacher who goes into the classroom be given opportunities for resensitizing, reorientation, new information about the community, the student, and so on, but also the administrators, the counselors, and even the janitors and other service personnel, in order that every person in that institution can be geared to the same level of contribution to the student's survival. This is what I mean by the process of sensitizing and the importance of it.
You also talked about the myths of miseducation, was it, about black children? Often hear these terms about educable students and non-educable students. Do you think that the public school system is geared toward this perhaps unconsciously, that...
Well, I think that unconsciously many educators contribute to the myth of the uneducability of black and other minority students. And I think this is very sad because it reflects an astonishingly naive outlook or insight on the question of human potential, what human potential is all about. Now, recent studies by scientists in the area of human potential, as released by the National Institutes of Health, indicate that these suppositions by and theories by William James that originated around the turn of the century, the early 1900s, that only 10% of the potential of the average human being was required to handle the most rigorous demands of the most difficult academic programs was sort of an exaggeration. Recent findings indicate that only 6% of the potential of the average human being is needed to handle the most difficult academic programs. And yet, we live in a society where young people are told very early in life that you have to be some kind of super intellectual being to aspire to a career in medicine or to a career in nuclear physics or something like this. And it's very unfortunate that this false perspective of the human potential is causing educators to make some terrifying decisions that work to the disadvantage of a young person.
What does teacher accountability mean, and what kind of pressures does it put upon educators, school administrators, and teachers?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that the question of teacher accountability, discussion of teacher accountability, is an extension, actually, of a discussion of human potential. If we can take it that human potential is far more than is required to meet the demands of our everyday academic programs, then something is terribly wrong. Somebody is failing miserably. Now, up to this point, as those of us know who live most of our lives in an academic environment, every time the student failed, it was his failure. In the event the student didn't achieve the objectives of the course, whatever those objectives might be, the failure burden resided in the student himself. In fact, with the way we do things in our society, if the student succeeds, the teacher usually talks about my beautiful student. And the teacher usually takes bows for the beautiful teaching job that he or she did. But the minute the student fails, they say, you failed. You failed. Your failure. You see what I mean? And the student is the one who has to bear, for maybe the balance of his life, the mark of Cain in the educational world, the F or the E, however you record your failures. I'm suggesting that one aspect of teacher accountability may reverse the grading process, where the students grade the teacher, and the accumulation of failing grades assessed to the teacher by the student will result in the teacher's demise rather than the student's demise. Seems to make more sense to me, actually.
Well, that threatened the teacher's authority, though, if students can say, in effect, that I'm not learning because of your incapabilities as a teacher.
I think that's exactly what's wrong in our school classrooms today, the authority of the teacher. One of the basic changes that must take place in education is a restructuring of the relationships between the teacher and the student. The business of the master and the slaves has become such an inherent part of our society that we take it for granted. You know, it goes back to the original plantation days when white people were treating black people like they were unhuman. We're now in a situation where we have an extension of the plantation in the classroom, where all of the students sitting there in their little orderly rows are slaves, and the teacher up at the front is the master. Sometimes it's sort of ridiculous, because going beyond the implications of the accumulation of wisdom among the students, very often within the same classroom there's a student who is much more informed on a particular question than the teacher. But this is not the important thing. I think that what's important is that the classroom ought to be a learning environment where everybody learns. And in order for a learning environment of the highest order to exist, there has to be a certain kind of freedom
that simply cannot prevail in the master-slave situation, you see? So that when we find a teacher who is sufficiently secure to be able to relate to a student or a group of students in this way, then I think we've maybe taken the first step toward identifying the perfect teacher. And I think that we have to strive not only toward identifying, but being able to create the perfect teacher. And the only way that we can do so is by, number one, a teacher who does not see herself or himself with a halo on his head, knowing all there is to know about a particular subject. A teacher who is not going to be threatened because students ask questions that they cannot answer. A teacher who does not need the weight of authority in order to feel comfortable with the students. These are some of the first steps.
You spoke this morning about profit motive in the educational school system. You believe there's a profit motive? Where does this come in within the system?
Well, I think that up to this point, teachers, administrators, and others in education have been rewarded for the failures that they have achieved. That is to say that they have had pay raises, promotions, and so on, despite the fact that their output is less than 50% usually, and sometimes down to the 10% level that I alluded to earlier. Now, I think that we have to introduce a new kind of profit component into the picture. But to give you the background for what I'm trying to say, I have to cite the situation in Chicago where Dr. Redmond has invited in a private company to take over the task of teaching about 1,200 students who are below grade level how to read. This organization will be compensated on the basis of its successes and only on the basis of its successes. It could end up losing all of its income for the entire year period involved. Now, I'm not against this. I think that anything that gives hope of being able to do a better job than we've done in the future is commendable. But I think that also we ought to change the reward structure or the profit structure for those inside of education too. There ought to be incentives based upon the ability to do a good teaching job, the ability to achieve the so-called objectives of the educational institution. And supposedly, this is the success of the student. Now, there's a third factor related to the profit-making situation of the private organization. I think that increasingly, business and industry are going to be called upon to participate in the financing of education, both public school education and higher education. And I think that the profit motive that prevails in business is going to cause them to have a number of apprehensions over the inefficient way that education is now operating. Therefore, if we would maintain our present independence, we'd better start doing something about our present inefficiency before someone forces us.
Out of some 41,000 students here at the University of Illinois, there's approximately only 1,200 black undergraduates and graduate students. Several years ago, that number was almost half. Where would you assign the responsibility here or the inadequacy here to the high schools, to the public school system? Why indeed aren't there more black eligible college students attending the University of Illinois?
Well, first let me say I think it's a tragic situation that only 1,200 out of more than 41,000 students are black, especially when we recognize that the black population of the state of Illinois is estimated at 2 million. In actuality, of all of the state institutions, I think that Southern Illinois has the largest population of black students. They have around 2,500. But when you put all of the four-year state institutions together, you have something like 6,000 or less. This is a tragic circumstance in the light of the tremendous needs of the community for educated, competent, trained individuals with a commitment to come back to the community. Now, I think that the blame for this lies in every aspect, actually, of the society. all of our institutions are to blame. I think that what we see in the colleges today is a direct result of the racism that is an inherent part of the way in which this society operates. And until we do something to eliminate racism from America as a way of life, we will continue to have a very small pool of so-called qualified young people to draw upon. Now, the university is represented by the University of Illinois and others of the same status, has a direct responsibility for intervening in the situation as they now find it. It is not enough for this university to go out and select a number of students that they think qualify in traditional terms. I think that this university has a responsibility for pioneering new ways of providing educational opportunity and executing educational responsibility. That's what the commitment of this university ought to be. I think that there ought to be some real concrete goals specified for the university in terms of the black student population. If the black student population, if the total student population is 41,000, then I tell you that the black student population ought to be 8,000, a minimum of 8,000 in the next 5 years. And then where ought it to be another 5 years after that? Then I would tell you, predicated on the same figure of 40,000, and I would dare this university to increase that figure more than 40,000 until these other figures are achieved. I think that in the next 5 years, we ought to have 15,000 black students in attendance at this college. Now, there are some things happening in Chicago, in the community colleges, and other aspects of the state educational system that assure us that there will be that kind of population for the University of Illinois at Urbana to select from. But I'm afraid also that there's a great deal of homework that the university is going to have to do in order to improve not only its recruitment rates, but to improve its retention rates. I wonder if that answers the
yes,
question.
Yes, it does.